Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up a little later in the program, is Pennsylvania closer to a cap-and-trade program to control emissions? But up front, while the challenges facing black boys in this country have gotten a lot of attention, issues facing girls of color, especially black girls, often aren't addressed. Black girls are more likely to be suspended from school, restrained physically, and are more subject to corporal punishment in school. Society sometimes sees black girls as angry and more adult than they are. Tonight at 8 on WITF-TV, you can see Push Out, the criminalization of black girls in schools. It's a documentary film about young people of color who don't often get discussed or recognized for the challenges they face. We're having our own discussion today with Sabina Grant Spencer, assistant principal at Harrisburg High School SciTech campus. Ms. Grant Spencer, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Also, Jenny Chavis. She's an attorney with the Chavis Law Firm. Ms. Chavis, glad to have you on today's program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Okay, let me do this again. I've been giving all morning long another 800 number. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. If you have a question or comment, you can leave on WITF's Facebook page. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We're also joined by Erica Pinkney, a consultant and associate clinical director with the Human Service Organization. Ms. Pinkney, we're glad to have you on today's show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So everyone joining the conversation here, with the four of us having this conversation, anyone who wants to jump in to answer these questions and follow up, go right ahead. I'll just start with the premise of this. Do black girls face unique challenges, especially in school? Who wants to tackle that one right off the bat?
This is Dr. Grant Spencer. Yes, I believe they do. They have unique challenges because for a myriad of reasons. Typically, when black girls are coming to school, and it, you know, it varies with age, et cetera, there's perceptions in regards to facial expressions, for example, how they may talk. If, you know, they talk with their hands or if their voice is elevated. Sometimes there's negative perceptions that there's arguments or things going on, and it can be just a regular conversation. I've seen some situations where our girls, you know, are dealing with other issues at home, and they're, you know, having to take care of younger siblings, et cetera. So when they come into school, you know, they may be tired. You know, it can be just different things, and you have to be understanding because every case is unique. Every case is unique with our young ladies. And, you know, again, our schools are supposed to be the safe haven and, you know, where we do welcome any and everyone, regardless of what experience they're going through. And it's really important for us to always remember that.
Dr. Pinkney?
Yes, I would say absolutely. I mean, to Dr. Spencer's point, it's like homelessness. Some of our children are dealing with homelessness, severe grief and loss, parental incarceration, parental unemployment. So all of these systemic factors are absolutely going to impact who we see and how they present once they enter the school environment.
Jenny Chavis, would you like to weigh in?
Sure. So I think I have just a slightly different perspective in seeing how the issues are dealt with within the court system. So I think that sometimes there's a perception of, you know, black girls either being more aggressive than, say, the non-black counterparts. Perhaps it's the disposition on the cases are disproportionately different for black girls. And so once they're in the system, that then creates this myriad of other challenges that just really compounds itself upon the other. Also then, depending upon the community that the black girl is coming from, the resources that are available to really combat prevention or to combat recidivism might not be there. So you have individuals who work in the community, other women. I know there are about three or four programs just in Harrisburg alone that are grassroots program where people are literally taking the money out of their pocket to really help black girls to prevent them from going within the system, whether it is Young Women Empowerment Academy. I know that Delta Sigma Theta, I know they did the GEMS program. There's the Pearls program Angela Bates was doing, the SWAG program by Carla Johnson, that are really trying to make an effort. But because resources appear to be very scarce, you have a lot of individuals trying to poke their finger in the dam to keep it from bursting.
The three of you have said that there is a perception issue when it comes to black girls. Who is perceiving black girls as being angry? You mentioned facial expressions, how they talk. Also, you know, they may be more, I don't know, I get the sense, and the research has shown that many people think that black girls are older than what they are. But who has this misperception? Is it whites, other blacks, is it all people, or is it just like white teachers, white educators that have, or white people in the court system that have this misperception?
Well, I think it's a matter of just cultural differences, and I think that that's where the perception starts, whether it's the implicit bias, because not only is it where, you know, black girls are perceived as appearing to be older or more mature, there's a higher expectation, or the belief that because they're more physically developed that they're going to perhaps be more physically aggressive. But, you know, even as a grown woman, where I'm often told, don't be perceived as an angry black woman, that comes from whether someone who's white, whether it's someone who's Asian, someone from a different culture who's taking perhaps my facial expression as being angry or mean or aggressive. So I think that it can come from a lot of different perspectives. And then if you have individuals who don't understand the black girl, who are in the decisions of making the decision regarding criminal cases or making the decision with, you know, children and youth cases, it really does impact the life of that individual.
I think too, if the media also contributes to that perception, because if you look at the wide display of how black women can be perceived, or is it a limited funnel effect where we're seen and perceived in majority of shows as confrontational and disrespectful and all these things. So if you see that on TV, then you don't know me as a black woman or a black girl. And you're going to say, oh, yeah, I see. That's how they act. That's what they do. I see it on TV. So the media can also perpetuate stereotypes and thoughts and ideas about how young ladies are versus what they really are, depending on their situations and background.
Dr. Pinkney, I mentioned in the introduction that there has been so much attention on black boys and black men and the challenges that they face, often, you know, especially during 2020 and since late May, with the protest across the country, there has been so much attention focused on black boys and black men. Why aren't black girls, black women getting as much attention? Why aren't there more discussions like the one we're having this morning?
I believe, too, there were historical roles, and research and studies had reported that for time on, it was girls will be girls and boys will be boys. So if boys acted out in an aggressive or physical aggressive kind of way, then it was okay, it's expected. But girls were kind of seen as just the catty, gossiping, petty girls, mean girls. But now we're seeing charges in different cases in the news that girls are being charged for more severe crimes that you would have otherwise thought boys would have been involved with. So when we think about black men and black boys, a colleague of mine did a research study looking at reading levels and how early not being able to read and automatically falling behind in school, you're less and less likely to move forward in your academic environment. Therefore, it's easier for you to act out because you don't want to be ridiculed for not being able, just looking at reading levels, and then that pipeline to prison that comes as a result of that. So the girls are definitely acting out in more ways, and it's something that we can't ignore anymore. We have to have these conversations and move from conversations into this cycle of change model.
Dr. Grant Spencer, I'm curious, as assistant principal at Harrisburg High School's SciTech campus, I don't know whether you can talk just about SciTech specifically, but your observations, do black boys get more attention in school than black girls?
Well, I can talk from my experience in general in education, and you in the beginning of my career over 20-something years ago, originally you saw more of the African-American males getting more attention in regards to the behavior, et cetera. But then as the years progressed, you started to see more situations where African-American girls were getting more attention, and particularly you start to see it in the younger years, you know, such as kindergarten, first and second grade, and then later on, if you see in the same type of things, you see it as they go through the system, you know, the educational system up into their high school years. But again, to just reiterate, you saw more of that in the beginning, like I said, about 20-something years ago, early 90s, I'm just speaking from my own personal experience, you saw more of the boys, but over the last I would say maybe 10 years or so, I've witnessed more girls getting the negative attention in regards to, you know, behavior or response to their actions within the school.
And I don't just mean negative attention. I don't want to make this sound
right.
But even academically.
Yes, because, again, you know, typically, as was stated previously, you know, you look at it, oh, you know, boys will be boys, and then, you know, girls, they, you know, they you may see some academic issues, you may not see some academic issues, but the focus was more on boys. Now you do see scenarios where girls are experiencing challenges in reading and math, you know, different areas. And then you also see experiences where girls are just really excelling in math and the sciences, you know, excelling beyond belief, you know. So you do see both. You do see both. But, you know, unfortunately, that when you do start to see these gaps, that's a part of the achievement gap. And then you got to ask the questions, why? What happened? Where did this gap begin?
You know, something that you just mentioned, girls accelerating in the sciences. You know, we've produced several programs of, you know, and I'm not just talking about African-American girls, but girls overall are underrepresented when it comes to occupations, their majors in college and university, when it comes to math, science, you know, the STEM topics. Have you seen any changes there? I mean, you're at SciTech, so the female students you see, but have you seen any changes, and any changes in particular with African-American girls that are now interested in going into maybe a STEM-related occupation or, you know, be excelling at the science and math technologies?
Yes, I can answer for here. Yes, we've seen that because that is our focus, and we have girls that are African-American girls that are going to higher education where they are majoring in biology, chemistry, you know, the science majors. And it's excellent to see. And it's because, you know, we're giving them that exposure here where they are excited to be a part of that field and realizing that, hey, this is something that I can do. That, you know, maybe when I was told when I was younger, oh, you're not good at math, you're not good at science, but they're seeing that, hey, I am good at this. I'm great at this. I actually enjoy this, and I love this, and they're taking it to a higher level when they go on to college. So, yes, I've seen that.
Jenny Chavis, what about the law? What about the legal field and African-American women?
I don't think that it is growing at the numbers that I would like to see, and I think it's the exact same issue, where I don't think that it's necessarily an overt discouragement to go into the profession, but if it's not, and I'm going to use the word that was just used, if we're not exposed to it, then it doesn't become, we're not able to grasp it as a reality. If you take, you know, the few black girls who are able to dream about becoming a lawyer and then be able to commit to that and, you know, really have some opportunities to allow them to do so, that's great. But as a whole, I think that we are able to talk ourselves out of it versus talking ourselves into it. When I have a chance to go to schools and talk at middle schools, there's usually one or two young ladies who will say that they're interested in becoming a lawyer, and then trying to make the connection, encourage them. It's a lot of work, but just getting them exposed to other Black female attorneys is very difficult, but it's essential. There aren't that many Black female attorneys in this particular area, in central, you know, Pennsylvania area. You know, we are few and far between, and we often discuss how can we increase the numbers, but we realize it's not just going to law schools or going to colleges, rather, but it's even starting in the, at that elementary age to expose them to this profession, that it is possible, and this is how you can do it. But it's just an opportunity to see the lawyers and then be able to model it.
Dr. Pinkney, Jenny Chavis just mentioned middle school. And this film that will air on WITF-TV tonight, Push Out, the Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools, they profile several young African-American women, girls, and, you know, they talk about some of the issues that they face, the challenges they faced. One consistent thing I heard during that film and these young women that were talking is that if they had any trauma, if they had any kind of challenge, or you know, what we were talking about earlier of about how they were being misperceived, that it started in middle school, that it was when they were 12, 13. I mean, that is a very challenging time for anyone. But is it particularly difficult for young Black women?
Absolutely. I think the need for trauma-informed services, initially, I've been in the field 18 years, so we saw, say, 10, 15 years ago, it was always fix the child. But the child has a home, the child has a family, the child has all kind of different life experiences that have been presented to them, and now they are just dealing with that. So they're looking at the messages that they already have about themselves coming into adolescence, and then the messages that are reinforced. I'm not good enough. I'm not pretty enough. I'm not this. I'm not that. So that can definitely perpetuate. The informative years are challenging in itself, but then you compound that with adolescence. You compile that with systemic factors. You compile that with any other number of traumas that could have happens for that child during her informative years. Yes, by the time you see a 14-year-old, they're probably very angry and annoyed and not the most pleasant person. But that also comes with how do they deal with that? What skills do they have at such a young age to be able to manage and work through that appropriately without ending up in the criminal justice system or some other system that they should not necessarily be a part of?
So what has to happen? What has to happen that we as a society, schools in general, are addressing the challenges that young Black girls are facing, Dr. Pinkney?
I think Jenny spoke to this earlier about the grassroots organizations. You know, I just wanted to name off just a couple, too. Like, there's the National Council of Black Women, the Young Professionals of Color, there's the Young Women Empowerment, Betty Chappaz, or the Academy, and GEM through Delta Sigma Theta. There's other Divine Nine organizations. So if you're in your community, look to these different groups and organizations and see how you can partner. And you can just be a good person and personal mentorship. Right now, I'm not a formal mentor, but yet I have three young ladies that I'm mentoring that are college transitioning. You know, just do it because it's the right thing to do. So it's about that vision of having those community networks and building that old school, just the village. It takes a village to raise a child. So it's going to be a little bit of everybody, coaches, community, pastors, leaders, all of us coming together to be able to, like I said earlier, have the conversation, but show the need that there is a need for this, have the conversation, and then move into action.
Dr. Grant Spencer, what I'm hearing from Dr. Pinkney and I hear throughout the film is that these young women need support, whether it's a mentor, whether it's an organization, whether it's in school, a teacher, or the parents. They need support.
And yes, I would agree. This is a whole village support, support system that is required, to be able to really come together like we used to do back when in the neighborhoods where the grandmothers, anyone, always looked out. There was so many different forms of mentors, but in partnerships with the school. That is key. And then even to revisit the point when you asked about the middle school and the things that you see that's going on in middle school and the challenges that middle school girls have to deal with, you know, all over, and the support that's needed. That support even needs to begin back in the preschool years, you know, because there's so different many different formats of trauma that children may have been exposed to, and then after, over time, it becomes like layers on the onion, and you have to keep pulling them back to be able to address each issue. But if we can have some myriad of supports in place for the students, the families, the schools, the communities to be able to center around our children, that would be very beneficial.
Jenny Chavis, I'll let you have the last word. What has to be done? How can we make it better for young women of color?
Well, I'm definitely hopeful. I'm definitely hopeful because I know that there are people out there who want to make a difference, who want to continue to build programs and to build the mentorships, just like the other ladies talked about. But I think the biggest factor is going to be, well, not a biggest, the biggest, but a factor is going to be people outside of the Black community caring enough to also want to see a difference being made within the Black community. And that understanding that by being able to make a positive impact in the life of Black girls, it benefits society as a whole, that is not to the detriment of any other girl or boy or any other culture, but that it is a way in which we can build our community together. So there is no weak link, so to speak. But I think that once we are able to build hope within the community, take it to the more practical steps, and then we just have to get to work. And that's it.
Dr. Sabina Grant Spencer, assistant principal at Harrisburg High School SciTech, Dr. Erica Pinckney, a consultant and associate clinical director of Human Service Organization, and Jenny Chavis, an attorney with the Chavis Law Firm. Thank the three of you for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Just want to remind you that you can see that film, that documentary, tonight at 8 on WITF-TV, Push Out, The Criminalization of Black Girls in Schools. It will open your eyes and maybe change your thinking of the challenges that Black girls face. That's tonight at 8 on WITF-TV. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News. And all things regional, I'm Scott Lamar.
What does civility mean? NPR asked and heard a lot of different answers.
Something that reflects good citizenship and is orderly behavior.
Civility is used actually to shut down discussion.
I'm Layla Faldin, and public radio is your home for different perspectives, shared with the context you need and the respect we all deserve. Here's how you can support civil conversation on this station.
Call 1-800-233-9483 or contribute online at WITF.org. Good morning, everyone. I'm Kara Williams-Frye, Chief Content Officer at WITF, and I'm joined this morning by Ron Hetrick, our President and CEO. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, Kara. It's great to be with you here again virtually.
And virtually is the key because we are not in the same space at all, are we?
We are not. No, I am at home in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and you are in our studio, correct?
Yes. And we're also joined behind the scenes with Joe Ulrich, who's in another studio right beside me. And Joe's not on mic, I don't think. So hi, Joe. I'm letting everyone know that you're back there. One of the things Joe does is WITF Music, and that is a spectacular program that we do monthly here, both, it's all multimedia on the news. You hear it on the radio station every once a month, but it's also on television, it's also on a website, it's also WITF.org. So, I mean, we do a whole lot of things here at WITF, and I think we do them pretty well. What do you think, Ron?
Absolutely, and you know, WITF Music is a wonderful contribution to the arts in our community. So in addition to the wonderful news and information that you get through WITF Radio and what you see online, WITF Music is one of those wonderful arts-based programs that allow us to tap into a different part of our community in a special way.
Yes, and so different parts of our community. There's so many communities that we represent that we are a part of. I mean, everyone who works here lives in our communities as well, and we care about our communities. And so election 2020 is just around the corner. It's just ahead. And it's something that our staff has been focused on for quite a while, including the primary and now heading into the general.
Yeah, and you know, we've gotten more comfortable with being able to get out into the community with the proper precautions, we've actually been doing some great work through our America Amplified project and with our election 2020 coverage that you've been hearing on air.
Yeah, America Amplified is a really interesting program. It's a national program. A few stations across the United States were granted an opportunity to kind of really go into communities. We were supposed to go to coffee shops and auditoriums and libraries and embed our reporters for a week at a time to really get to know a community. And obviously with COVID-19, all of that changed. However, our reporters remained committed and remain committed to being able to hear the voices of everyday people who come from all walks of life, because that's what public media is all about. We want you to hear different perspectives and make your own decisions. And so America Amplified, our national project, our Pennsylvania project, and our regional and state project with Election 2020, it's such an important part of who we are. And that's why your listener support at 1-800-233-9483 is so important. And if you like the website, you can go to WITF.org and donate that way as well. We're fiercely committed to our communities, and we live here.
We live here. We work here. You can see in normal times, you can see our staff members out in the community, emceeing events, speaking to classes, hosting tours at our building. And yes, we are proud to be part of the 19 counties that we serve.
If you make a contribution today, you will help not only yourself, your community, but also keeping the people of this region informed. So call 1-800-233-9483 or contribute online at WITF.org. And thank you.
Welcome back to Smart Talk. And speaking of the election, starting next Monday, Smart Talk will be featuring interviews with candidates for the congressional offices and statewide offices. That is starting on Monday. Pennsylvania's Environmental Quality Board voted earlier this week to take another step toward the state possibly becoming part of the multi-state regional greenhouse gas initiative. That could mean caps on emissions and credits being sold on carbon allowances. To tell us more about what is referred to as REGGIE is State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Rachel McDevitt. Rachel, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, you can send a question or a comment to @smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I have to say, Rachel, that for a lot of people, this is complicated because there are a lot of steps involved. There are a lot of things that happen. So maybe we'll identify and define some of the basics of it. What is REGGIE, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative?
Yeah, and Scott, people who study this will even tell you that it's complicated, so no one should feel bad. But so what is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative? It is an effort among 10 northeastern and New England and mid-Atlantic states to limit the carbon dioxide emissions from their power plants in the electricity sector. So they set a cap of how many tons of carbon dioxide their power sector can emit. Those are sort of converted into allowances. So each allowance is worth a ton of carbon dioxide. So those power plants have to buy allowances in order to emit that pollution. And then the funds go back to the states, and they can spend those funds on, they could spend it on whatever they want, but most of them spend it on energy efficiency measures and clean energy programs.
So how and when did this start?
So REGGIE has been around since 2009. The original states in the program they agreed to do it around 2005, but they sort of delayed implementation, and it officially started in 2009. But for Pennsylvania, we started our journey here last October when Governor Tom Wolf signed an executive order directing our Department of Environmental Protection to draft a regulation that would have us join REGGIE.
You know, I remember over the years that there were a lot of people who encouraged Pennsylvania to become part of the Greenhouse Gas Initiative. Why did it take so long? I mean, basically, we're talking about 13, 14 years. What took so long for Pennsylvania to think about joining REGGIE?
I'm not sure what took so long, Scott. I mean, Governor Tom Wolf originally ran on having, he ran for governor on having Pennsylvania join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative as part of his platform, and then he did not try to join during his first term. He has, you know, started the process in his second term. And before that, I mean, I can't really speak to before Governor Wolf, but I would say that Pennsylvania, we could probably look to the arguments happening right now, Pennsylvania is a huge energy generator, and we export a lot of electricity. So I think that makes it a little more complicated when you propose it, putting a price on their emissions.
So what will joining REGI actually do?
So what joining REGI will do, the goal is to drive down carbon emissions. And so the Department of Environmental Protection estimates that over the period between 2022 and 2030, that carbon dioxide emissions could be prevented on the scale of 188 million tons. So that's a 25% decrease between over an 8-year period, that decline in carbon dioxide emissions. They also estimate that the state will get $300 million in that first year, and that amount from that allowance auction will decline slightly over the decade to be more in the $200 million range by 2030. And then there are some co-benefits that they're predicting, you know, when you have less pollution in the air. And there are other pollutants that get decreased when you cut down on your carbon dioxide as well. Things like sulfur dioxide, which can have health effects that can affect your lung function. So they're also predicting increased, you know, better health outcomes for people who live near polluters. And they're also hoping that it's going to grow the economy because they're going to have this money to reinvest.
When is Pennsylvania slated to join REGI?
So they are hoping, the Wolf administration is hoping to join by 2022. But that is dependent on the long regulatory process that we have just embarked on.
Yeah, and it is a long regulatory process. You know, I was careful to word my introduction when I talked about the Pennsylvania Environmental Quality Board voting earlier this week to take another step. What was that step?
Yeah, the Environmental Quality Board, which for those who don't know, is the sort of governing board for the Department of Environmental Protection. They exist to adopt regulations and advise the department on policy. And so the Environmental Quality Board, which is made up of 20 members, most of them are appointees from Governor Tom Wolf, but there's also a few citizens from what's called the Citizens Advisory Council and a few members of the General Assembly. So they get together and they vote on what could be a regulation. So what they did on Tuesday is they approved the draft regulation that could allow Pennsylvania to join REGI. And that draft regulation will now be open to public comment for a period of 60 days. I don't believe it's been published in the Pennsylvania Bulletin yet, so I'm not sure when that 60-day period starts. But there will be 60 days of public comment. They will have at least five public hearings to collect public comment. And then the draft regulation needs to be revised into a final regulation. The DEP will take in all those comments, all that feedback, find out what their weak points are, revise the regulation, and they'll present it to the Environmental Quality Board again. And then after that, there's even more regulatory review from other agencies. The Attorney General would have to look over it to make sure it's not violating any of Pennsylvania's laws, and then it would finally be adopted as a regulation. And so that's why Pennsylvania probably won't join until at least 2022.
I think from what you just described, 2022, surprised it's moving that fast with all the things that,
right,
that you described. I mean, now we understand why this can be so confusing, because mm-hmm. there does seem to be a lot of bureaucracy. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, there's a lot of steps that are going on here from what you described. We have a comment here from a listener, Kit. And, you know, one of the things that I want to read this and then, you know, just add something to it. Kid asks, isn't paying to pollute still polluting since the amount of energy remains the same or increasing? The point that he's making, we have heard often from those who may not be on board with this, that, you know, pollution doesn't stop at state lines. So, you know, when you have some trading going back and forth and buying of credits, I mean, does that really have an impact on what's going out there into the atmosphere?
So, yeah, so I'll address that question that first, that paying to pollute still polluting. I mean, it is. But what this is supposed to be, and this is a market-based program, right? You're charging emitters for what they're emitting. And so economists will tell you that, I mean, sending that price signal is telling them, you know, you need to save money, to be more, you know, economically efficient, it would be more efficient to not emit as much. So it's setting that tone, it's setting that signal that you can't just put out your emissions for free anymore, you're going to have to pay for them, because they cause damages to the rest of us, and we have to bear the cost in that case. So what a cap and trade program is supposed to be a market correction, and charging for those emissions. And the cap that is set, the cap does tighten over time so that emissions are supposed to be going down. But you have a point. I mean, the emissions are only going down in that regulated area. And so we do hear a lot about leakage. And leakage is when other areas that don't have a cap and trade program, don't abide by the same rules, would ramp up their electricity production, maybe burn more fossil fuels to make up for any decline that's happening in the regulated area, and that would be Pennsylvania. So we do hear a lot from opponents to joining RGGI that it's not going to have any effect on emissions because they're all just going to be shifted over the state line into Ohio and West Virginia and their coal-fired generating plants, and it's really just going to be a wash. But I've talked to a lot of people about RGGI in the last month and a half or so, Scott, and experts in this are really not that worried about the leakage. There has been leakage from the other RGGI states as they have drawn down their emissions, but most economists classify it as modest, and it's not going to totally offset any reductions that Pennsylvania does.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're speaking with State Impact Pennsylvania reporter Rachel McDevitt. And if you'd like to read more about RGGI, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and Rachel's reporting, there is a link on our webpage, WITF.org/smarttalk, but you can read about it at State Impact on WITF.org. There's a whole lot of other information concerning Pennsylvania's energy economy. And of course, the environment goes right along with that. But go to WITF.org. If you have a question or comment, we have about 10 minutes left in the segment. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Phone number, once again, 1-800-729-7532. I bring that up because we are in fall fundraising campaign right now, and our 800 number for Smart Talk is different than the one for pledging. We'd like you to call the one for fundraising as well, but still, another 800 number for Smart Talk. It is 1-800-729-7532. Rachel, you mentioned, you know, that this started back in the mid-2000s with this. Mm-hmm. What about the other states? Have you heard how, with them being part of RGGI for some maybe a decade, some for more, some for less, what experiences they have had? Has it had any impact on emissions?
So, excellent question, Scott. And that was sort of the focus of my piece that is up on State Impact. .npr.org/Pennsylvania and WITF.org, because that is the question. The arguments in the legislature over this have been so divisive. They've been so far apart from each other that I really did want to know, like, well, what does REGI do? What does it work? Does it actually drive down emissions? And so the states that are in REGI seem to be pretty happy with it. I talked to representatives from the states of Massachusetts and Maryland and their departments of the environment, and they tout REGI as a great success, that it's helped drive down emissions. But an economist will tell you that actually pinpointing reductions to the REGI program can be difficult because REGI is a modest program. It's not very strict, and it came into being at a time when we saw this huge energy transition and the Great Recession. So let me take that a couple steps at a time. So REGI, you know, officially started in 2009, which was the Great Recession, and the Great Recession lowered energy demand. So people didn't need as much electricity. They weren't using as much energy. Emissions went down because of that. And then also around 2009, if you recall, Scott, natural gas started booming in Pennsylvania and a few other places. So, you know, we started getting this wash of cheaper, cleaner burning natural gas into the energy grid, and that drove emissions down as well. But REGI did help in some aspects. So again, economists will say just having that price on carbon sends that signal to emit less. And some other studies, some independent studies, have found that REGI was responsible for maybe half of the reductions in the REGI states. Other people have decided it's responsible for about 10% of the reductions in the REGI states.
It's hard to tell.
There's also that, I'm sorry?
I just said it seems hard to tell.
It can be hard to tell. What the states in the REGI program will tell you is that overall in the REGI region, emissions from power plants have fallen by 45% from a level that was measured between 2006 and 2008. So they have seen a 45% reduction. However, giving that credit can be difficult, and it is probably because of a variety of factors. It's because of, you know, possibly because of the price on carbon, but also the energy shift, the Great Recession, and because these states get money back in from the program from those allowance auctions, and they've been spending it in energy efficiency and clean energy, that has also helped to drive down emissions. So it's a big combination of things.
But there is opposition to REGI here in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania joining REGI. What is that opposition? What's it about?
Absolutely, there's opposition. So the opposition is a little bit twofold. Governor Tom Wolf, he wrote his executive order directing the DEP to join REGI by regulation. And there are some in the legislature that say that that is not allowed, that putting this price on carbon is essentially a tax, and the governor can't tax, only the General Assembly can tax. So there's one point of opposition. But a big point of opposition is that this regulation is going to hurt coal-reliant communities. You know, Pennsylvania is a, you know, still a coal state. We still produce a lot of coal. The other states in REGI, is important to note, they really don't. They've never had the mining that Pennsylvania has had, with the I say with the exception of Maryland, but they only have a little bit, really. And so coal-fired generation is expected to decline even more rapidly under REGI. It's already declining, to be clear, but joining REGI could make it go away faster. And the people who depend on those coal-fired power plants and the communities around them that rely on them for a tax base are going to be hit by this. And so that's really the loudest argument we're hearing from opponents in the General Assembly.
And there are a lot of Republicans who do oppose this. Do they have an alternative? And this is a question from a listener. Do the Republicans who oppose this have an alternative?
They have an alternative. I haven't heard about it.
Okay.
That's part of the criticism they lob back at Republicans who are saying is that it's not going to work, that it's not going to hurt these kids. But I have yet to see a plan, any of them, that helps these communities or addresses climate change.
So we have about a minute left, Rachel. I want to thank you very much for being on with us today, explaining what is a very complicated topic. So what happens next?
So next, the regulation goes for public comment. It will need to be, I believe, pushed.
Rachel, you still there?
Hear me,
okay.
Scott.
Okay, we're you're cutting in and out on us at this. Can you are you? Let me hear if you.
Yes.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
So the next step is going to be comment.
All right. Well, we've lost Rachel at this point, but I encourage you to go to WITF.org, State Impact Pennsylvania, to read her reporting on the regional greenhouse gas initiative. There's a lot that goes into it, as you heard. It is pretty complicated, but it does have to do with energy. It has to do with climate change. There is a lot going on. Coal mining industry has a lot going on, so I encourage you to do that. We will be back with you tomorrow, and amongst the topics we'll discuss, POW MIA Day, that is tomorrow on Smart Talk.
Smart Talk is produced by WITF as part of our mission to deliver relevant, high-quality programming. Support comes from Capital Blue Cross, which shares WITF's commitment to being a trusted resource in our communities. Smart Talk is also supported by UPMC, offering surgical care for the brain, spine, and peripheral nerves. More information can be found at upmcpinnacle.com/neurosurgery.
You like to be prepared. That's why you keep a trusty umbrella in your bag. And just like the weather, news can catch us off guard. I'm Camila Domonoski. When you get caught in a rainstorm, you have an umbrella because you're prepared. And when the world gets caught up in sudden breaking news, you have NPR for the facts and context you need. So keep us in your tote bag. Become a sustaining member now.
Call 1-800-233-9483 or contribute online at WITF.org. I'm Kara Williams-Rye, Chief Content Officer at WITF, joined this morning by Ron Hedrick, our President and CEO. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, Kara. It's great to be with you here virtually this morning.
Yes.
Again.
Yeah, virtually. We're in different studios and different places and different counties, but it's how we work here at WITF. It's how most of you are working at home, and we support you. You support us, so thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for listening to our fall fundraising campaign. And thank you very much for listening to Smart Talk. Smart Talk is a program we've had for over 10 years. It is a daily news and information show that we cherish, quite frankly. And, you know, as soon as COVID-19 hit, we pivoted. Every day, for weeks on end, we covered COVID-19 because it was important for people to hear more than just one line in the news, to have deep conversations about what the medical community needed to let you know, what the national to the regional to the local information meant for you in your community. Ron, I mean, Smart Talk was truly a place to go at the very beginning and still with COVID-19.
It was. It's pivoted a little bit now as there's been different important topics happening in the world around us. But you're right. At the very beginning, Smart Talk was there for everybody. We made it a point of ours. I know Scott and the team did a wonderful job of really connecting to the information and to the people that needed to get the word out about how to safely navigate the pandemic, which was new to all of us. And now that the pandemic has become more of a routine, if we're able to say that, we've actually been able to expand to other topics now and get into deeper conversations around the upcoming elections or around some of the civic unrest that's happening in society today.
Yeah, so WITF is about helping to build the community. We're part of the community. You're part of us. So if you can, please donate a little bit today. You could give online at WITF.org or call 1-800-233-9483. $5, $10, $25, $1 a day. It helps everyone. And some people aren't able to contribute right now. And that's okay, because you're there to help us. So if you can help us, if you can help everyone in your community get the news and information that they can trust on a daily basis, that would be wonderful. One of the other pivots, because we all were pivoting, was community engagement. We used to do lots of events with hundreds and hundreds of people. That's changed.
It has, and they've abruptly stopped, and I'm very proud that our team has set up a wide variety of virtual events. And this coming weekend, we're trying our first event at a movie theater, which will be really, really interesting.
Can we clarify it's not a movie theater?
It's a drive-in. Thank you. At a drive-in. Thank you. That would be alarming. But one of the greatest programs, I think, that have come out of some of these last couple months, and it started virtually, is our Toward Racial Justice series, where we've actually taken a deep look at the systemic racism topic and how it's emerging and happening in our community, and having really thoughtful and rich conversations around that topic.
And so with that in mind, WITF needs your generous support now more than ever in order to serve you. With our fierce and unwavering commitment and determination, we want to help you. We need you to help us. The critical power of WITF and public media to help inform our audiences is why we're here. So please give online at WITF.org or call 1-800-233-9483.